Let's get going. We'll start, thanks. All right, welcome. Thanks everyone for coming. There's been a bit of competition, I think, on for this last slot. There's actually some other sessions that I wanted to go to, but I felt it would be rude for me not to show up here. When I was putting sessions together for TechEd, I actually put in three submissions. One of them was a work folders one, which I did yesterday, and I got stuck between a Guthrie and a movie world. And the other two were on what's new in Active Directory and dynamic access control. And I was asked, well, you can have two slots. We want the work folders one. Which of the other two should we sacrifice? And having a look at it, I thought, we really need to have something on dynamic access control, but there's so many other good things around Active Directory that we need to have as well. So I thought, all right, rather than trying to be complete and have so much information that your brain sort of melt and explode, or even worse, running over time, what I've called this is a feature spotlight. Now, in the PowerPoint deck, which you can download after, there's about 109 slides. I have used section breaks in the PowerPoint deck to break up the sections by the features and the other things that are going to be talked about. There's going to be a lot of stuff flashing past. I haven't hidden the slides or done anything special for here, but we're not going to be stopping on them. There's going to be areas where I'm going to flip through, stop, spotlight. Want to have a look at this feature, want to give some explanations around things, because I think it's important to understand why this thing has been done this particular way. Then there'll be some other slides about the requirements and other bits and pieces for that feature, and we'll barrel on to the next one. Does that sound fair? Cool. So we've got a hit list. We'll have the spotlight features as we go through. We'll spend a bit more time on dynamic access control. And then right at the end, I haven't forgotten what's new in AD 2012 R2. I've got a page of things that are new in 2012 R2 AD, and each of the things that are mentioned there is actually a hyperlink to other online guides and things on TechNet for more information. So let's get started. The objectives for this session and for Active Directory in general, some of the new changes, is to really have a look at what things we've been spending time on, what things we have invested our effort in fixing up in AD, and why. We want to make sure that we can hit the actual requirements. It's no longer a case of being able to update to the latest version of Active Directory. The place where I work, we actually haven't been able to raise up to... We've got 2008 R2 domain controllers, but we're stuck at AD level 2008 because we have another component in our organization that is only supported by its vendor up to AD 2008. So I do understand that there are places which, you know, it's not all Microsoft, amazingly as that may seem. So we want to look at the things in AD that allow us to use some of these new features without having to raise the functional level of Active Directory as well. And also, given the sheer volume of topics, I want to make sure there's lots of links and other things and resources in the deck for you to drill down afterwards. The high level of things that we are looking at. One is to make sure that we've got a simplified deployment of Active Directory. By and large, for most organizations, the way that we have dealt with deploying Active Directory hasn't changed much in the last 13 years. We use the same methodologies, the same thought processes, and some of the vendors that we have do the work look like they haven't updated their documentation since then either. We do realise that it's very cloudy at the moment. Unless you've been walking around here this week with your eyes closed, you would have seen Azure everywhere. And there's been a lot of focus on not only Microsoft's cloud offerings, but on private clouds as well. So we want to make sure that Active Directory, and directory services solution, enables us to live and be ready for working in the cloud. We want to make sure that the management experience that we are using to deal with AD is consistent And also, we want to be able to use claims-based authorization. How many people at the moment have got in their organization domain controllers that aren't able to be virtualized, either because you don't support virtualized domain controllers or the vendor that you've got looking after your directory services will not support virtualized domain controllers? Hands up. We've got a scattering of people here, and that's unfortunate that that has to be the way. Don't need to have only physical domain controllers. It's not a bad idea to have one or two, but this day and age, if something can't be virtualized or someone's not willing to support something that's virtualized, they're living in the dark ages. So one of the goals with working with Active Directory was to make sure that we have the ability to fully support virtualized domain controllers. We want to make sure that we can take advantage of the other benefits that virtualization gives us. One of those benefits that's been around since virtualization really hit quite a few years ago was to be able to rapidly provision servers. Yet, the process that we use, even for virtual domain controllers, pretty much consists of building them up in exactly the same way that we would do a physical server. So we want to make sure that when we're dealing with virtual domain controllers, we do have a way of being able to rapidly provision them, really leveraging the virtualization benefits. We also want to make sure that the management of AD can be as simple as possible. Being able to do things remotely, for example, rather than having to physically touch the domain controllers. This is our smorgasbord. This is our buffet that we're going to walk through. And we're going to start with simplified deployment. DC Promo. If you run DC Promo from a prompt on server 2012, you get told that it's not there anymore. In fact, if you were at my session last year, you would have seen me shoot it and kill it and bury it in the corner of the stage in the other room. And it's still there. It's a bit smelly now. We've actually created a whole new wizard. That DC Promo, the code DC Promo, is actually dead and gone from 2012. It's a whole new wizard that's been developed. Unfortunately, the name in as it was being developed was entirely too much of a mouthful, so we've decided to call it DC Promo again. You now run DC Promo essentially from the Add Roles and Features wizard. You do the lot at once. And when you have finished installing the role and feature, you still don't have a domain controller. What you have done is you have put the bits and pieces and the tools that are required to interact with Active Directory on that box. And when you've finished running that wizard, you have the option of exposing the PowerShell script that was used to do it. So if you want to do this again on other multiple machines or be able to rapidly rebuild this box, provide your build documentation, you can take a copy of that script and bang it there in your build document so people aren't having to go click, click, next. It can also be done remotely. You do not need to be on that machine's console to do it. You use Server Manager. Once you have finished installing the roles and features in the box, then you have the ability to make it a domain controller. Now, when you make it a domain controller, it goes through and checks, and the target forest must be server 2003 functional or higher. You don't have to be on R2, at 2008 R2. And it will do checks for you. And when you are done, you have the ability to use Install from Media. Now, Install from Media has been around for a while. There are some problems with it, which I'll explain in a bit. But the main one is it does no longer require an offline defrag. Previously, if you were using Install from Media, you take a copy of the directory services database, you'd go to a remote site, He'd say, I've got my directory services database over here. I'll install my domain controller. I'm going to use this media instead. And the first thing it does is goes and talks to the original domain controller. And it says, give me some information. I'll go, oh, no, you need me to use this one over here. I'll go back and use this one over here. Oh, I've got some install from media here. This might have some white space in it. So the first thing I'm going to do is compact it. And if you've got an especially large directory services database, even if it's already been compacted before you've shipped it across, it'll still spend however much time. Some companies we've seen it take days to actually do an offline defrag of that database before it then goes, right, now it's ready for me to use. We go through the whole process, and it's a bit difficult to see the screen there. AD prep is now no longer required. All of the prerequisite stuff is being taken care of by the wizard. It will double check for you. If you want to do an AD prep for your domain and forest, you still can. If you really want to. If you're feeling nostalgic. And at the end, you get the ability to once again pull up PowerShell script for actually promoting something to being a domain controller. I'm going to skip past these ones. There's the install for media explanation. And just quickly stop here. ADFS, you might have seen a number of the other sessions, particularly around Office 365 and Azure services. If you're deploying Link in your organization, you'll know that ADFS can actually play a big, play a big part in it. With 2008 R2, you could pull down ADFS V2 as an optional extra. With 2012, ADFS version 2.1 actually ships in the box. There's no extra work required to actually get the bits for ADFS. Next. We have a virtual domain controller. The domain controller fails. Can we restore it from a backup? The answer is the consultant's answer. It depends. If you are using something that is aware of AD, you can do it, but there can be problems that are associated with this. And it is important to understand when you're looking at your virtualization platform, the problems that can exist if you are virtualizing domain controllers on that platform. Here's a scenario. We have two domain controllers. They've replicated with each other. And we've taken a snapshot, virtual machine snapshot. You'll see that the high water vector for the first one is 3,000, which is the highest USN from B. And you'll see that B has the high water vector mark of 1,000, which it's gotten from A. They merrily burble along in time and exchange more information. And then B crashes. So we go and restore B back to the snapshot because our virtualization admin, our person who's looking after our host platform, who isn't our AD administrator, knows that the quickest and the easiest way of getting a server back up and running so that people, the users, aren't screaming at them for being slow and interrupting services is just to restore from a snapshot when we knew things were working. They restore. At that point, the high water vector, the high watermark vector that B has from A was 1,000. So it communicates with A and says, you're my replication partner. I've got 1,000 as the last change that you'd sent me. Give me all the changes. We've had some users since it's come back up. Give me all the changes that have occurred since 1,000. And it does. And it works because it's had changes since 1,000. It's actually had quite a lot. And then DC1 goes, while we're talking, I've got 5679 as my high water mark vector with you. Can you give me all of the changes that have occurred on you since then? And it goes, yeah, I don't have any of those. In fact, we have a problem. Because not only don't I have any since that number's higher than the number that I've got for myself. We have an issue. So what it does is it goes, right, I'm going to write this in the event log, pop it in the replication log, disable inbound and outbound replication. I'm sitting quietly in a corner and sulking, and I turn off the net logon service. I shouldn't be talking to anyone anymore. However, this only occurs if it knows that it is out of date. Somebody has rolled it back in time, and it now understands that that is what has happened. What would have happened, however, if domain controller B had had a whole bucket load of changes, added new users, and had gotten above the high watermark vector that A had for it? Then we have a real problem. We have what are called USN bubbles. We have a whole series of accounts which have got the same SIDs that are already in use within the organization, and all hell ensues. And domain controller B is completely unaware of it, because at that stage, when A asks, give me everything that's above 5679, and it's sitting at 6,000, it goes, yep, here they are, bang. And I'm not giving you any of the ones that are below my level of 5679, because apparently you already have them. We have duplicate SIDs accessing similar resources. We have people that are locked out. We have somebody who has transient password problems where, depending upon which domain controller they are talking to, they might have their password authenticated or access denied. The solution is to make sure that the domain controller can understand that it has been rolled back in time, because the Active Directory database was never designed to be rolled back. So there's a new identifier called the VM generation ID. It requires the hypervisor to be aware of this identifier. And whenever a domain controller starts up, and whenever it goes to write in the AD database, it has a look at what it thinks the copy of the VM generation ID is, and the underlying host, the hypervisor platform, asks it what the VM generation ID is. And if the two are the same, it goes, we're all good, I am who I am. If, however, they are different, if I have rebooted from a snapshot, the VM generation ID will change, the domain controller will have a look and see it's different, and will go, we have a serious six-day episode happening here. For those who have seen the Arnie movie. Something has happened, something is not right, I am not who I am supposed to be. But instead of going and sitting in a corner and sulking, it knows that the changes that it had previously made are pretty much out there, somewhere, with its name attached to it. So the only way that I can get them back, because I don't have them here at the moment, is to change my name. What it does is it changes its invocation ID and does a few other little things. And then when it starts talking to the replication partners, they think it's somebody new. And they go, cool, I've got all this stuff that somebody who I used to be talking to but no longer seems to be around much did. So, and obviously you're not them, so you can have them. And all the information comes back. In order to be able to take advantage of this, you must be using a hypervisor that supports VM generation ID. If you're not in this situation, the only other really way of trying to keep safe as far as virtualized domain controllers is concerned is to make sure that whatever technology you are using to restore virtual domain controllers is aware of USN rollbacks and USN bubbles. Okay. Because we're sitting on a virtual platform, we want the ability to quickly recover things, particularly if we've got a disaster situation. And one of the first things we need to have getting up and running in a disaster situation, after disaster recovery, is our directory service, because so many things rely on it. And we have the ability to clone non-domain controllers in the virtual space. Why not have the ability to clone domain controllers as well? Well, it's a little trickier than just doing it as we do for file servers, but we do have a process for doing it. So first, we make sure that we've got a domain controller that is sitting on a hypervisor that does support VM generation ID. We also have to have a machine that's a DC that's the PDC emulator running Windows Server 2012. And we have a group called the Clonable Domain Controllers group. This is what this machine has to be in that group. First, it checks for any incompatibility components, takes them away, and then writes all the information in an XML file. It then shuts down and copies itself. We can then take that now turned off virtual machine hard disk and use it to clone a new domain controller. We can turn the old one back on again. When the new one comes up, because the VM generation ID has changed, starts up, it checks its VM gen ID, it's different. It is no longer who it thought it was. But it also goes, oh, hang on. If this is different, I need to reset my invocation ID anyway, and then I'll check and see if there's a DC clone config file. Because it might well be that instead of me being rolled back to a snapshot and me being who I thought I was, it could be that I am actually a clone. It's nice to know that. Runs through the process of doing a DC promo. So we've still called it DC promo, even though it's not really DC promo. It runs it with the fixed clone attribute. Parses the XML file to see which components are incompatible and make sure they're kept out. Configures the network settings, because I can't use the same network settings that I was using before. Remember, domain controllers typically have fixed IP addresses, and I don't want to give myself the same fixed IP address as the guy I got cloned off. Once I'm there, I can get on the network, I can locate the PDC and talk to them. The PDC goes, right, are you on the list? I'm not just having anybody show up and say, I'm a domain controller, thank you very much. I'll check and make sure that you are valid. If you are, I record your details, give you a nice big thumbs up, and you can go on, promote yourself, reboot, and you've now got a domain controller. You can rapidly provision as many domain controllers as you need very, very quickly using this method. It's actually not a bad way to do it if you need to have multiple domain controllers brought up in a DR situation. Typically, you might have one at your DR site. You might want to have multiples for a redundancy. This is actually a nice way of being able to have your DR procedures very quickly provision multiple domain controllers. Extra information there, as I said, and we're flipping through pretty quickly. We're going to jump through this fairly quickly too. There is a large number of platform changes that have occurred, including some improvements around relative IDs. Now, we've had some recent cases where people have actually run out of RIDs, which is an impressive feat, because the RID is actually a 2 to the 30 bit number. There is an extra bit that is used. In fact, this might be more familiar to you. That's that bit in the red at the end. There is an extra bit that gets used, and that bit was used for doing migrations from NetWare to Active Directory. So if you are in the process or thinking about in the future moving from NetWare to Active Directory, you probably don't want to go down the solution path at the moment. Wait until that's actually happened. But the SIDs, we know the SIDs must be unique, and within a domain, the RIDs must be unique, and every time a new account is created or something else, we increment the RID. The number is about 1 billion, a bit over. In order to exhaust our RID pool, we probably need to allocate 10,000 RIDs per day for the next 294 years. And yet some people, amazingly, have managed to do it. I know some people who, with their ISPs, they see if they can do download races. They see who can use up their quotas or the unlimited quotas. They try and download hard drives. Oh, bugger, you got to the 500 gig before me, so let's clear the hard drives and start again. All right. I don't know whether there's some weird organisations that try and do that to cycle through RIDs quickly. But there was a known bug, undocumented feature, that actually caused a RID pull to be asked for from the RID master. Try and do something, it failed, bugger, I'll go and ask for a new RID pull without actually exhausting the current RID pull. In other words, we could actually go through some very large RID pulls very, very quickly, much, much faster than 10,000 per day. We've actually set a limit now on the number of RIDs in the RID pool to 15,000. We've also allowed for that 31st bit to be used, but that's a one-way ticket. If you turn on allowing that RID, it doubles, obviously doubles the number. Actually, it's more than doubles. It doubles the number of RIDs that you can use. And we also have some warnings now built in. Previously, there was no real warning that you'd run out of RIDs until you got the cryptic message saying it could no longer create the security principle. Now we have a warning that will continually tell you that you are running out, and you'll hit a soft ceiling target at 90% of the RIDs being used, and you really shouldn't be at that stage. And then as an admin, you need to then allow it to go above that. And then when you hit the hard target of your RID pool is complete, hopefully you've found the problem and fixed it by then. But if you hadn't, you can always turn on that extra 31st bit and you've got another whole range of things to go through. There's the warnings, artificial ceiling, unlock the 31st bit, and we will quickly jump through the others. Off-premises domain join new, we have the ability now to not just do offline domain joins, but if we've got a machine out in a regional area that needs to be domain connected, particularly if our domain is direct access enabled, we have the ability to provide a remote blob accessible via a website that machine can connect to, can download, and can then be domain joined without actually having been connected to a domain connected network. All right. Really nice for a rapid provisioning of remote machines rather than having to build something locally and ship it out. With Windows 8 and the ability to access things to the Microsoft Store, we also have connected accounts. This is where you've got local accounts on your machine and you might want to connect it with a Microsoft account. In order to access the store, you do need a live account to be able to do that. We do have some limitations where you cannot connect an Active Directory user account to a live account. That's the live ID, it's not supported. Server SKUs do not support connected accounts. This is for the client side of things, but this is available now. And we will flip through lots of other things and get into the management stuff. Has anybody turned on the new Active Directory Recycle Bin? Hands up. Four, only a small smattering of people. All right, just let me check it. How many people are running Active Directory 2008 R2 or higher? Hands up, please. Why the heck haven't you turned on the recycle bin? Forest functionality? What a pain. So all of you who didn't put up your hand the first time but put it up the second time, it's forest functionality that's holding you back? Ah, well, we can fix that. There's now a GUI. 2012 AD has a GUI for the Active Directory Recycle. Look, even if it wasn't for the GUI, if you were still having to use 2008 R2, I'd still be turning on the recycle bin. It is not pretty having to go through doing authoritative restores and then fixing up however many accounts there have been damaged because some fat-fingered service desk person has managed to delete an OU, even though we've had the protect from accidental deletion. Oh, it says, are you sure? Yes, of course. And has deleted a whole tree of accounts rather than just deleting the individual user account that they were trying to annoy. Maybe it was a fear of PowerShell. Maybe it was a fear of using ADC Editor to actually go and do some of this stuff. But we've listened to the concerns that people had and said, you know what? We need to be able to go point, point, click. We've now got a GUI for the recycle bin. It only requires 2008 R2 forest functional level. So if you can at least get up to that and have the Active Directory, Windows Server 2012 Active Directory Administrative Center. It's like a web services model. Use that. We're going to spend a bit of time on dynamic access control. Let me just check. Has anybody here not heard of dynamic access control before? Please, hands up. All right, so most of you have. Fantastic. There's a few who haven't. Has anybody implemented dynamic access control? Hands up, please. I'm not seeing any hands at all. All right. I'm a bit surprised that nobody's used it, but let's cover the point behind this. Is anybody suffering from token bloat? Hands up. All right, for you guys particularly, listen to this. All right, listen to dynamic access control. And I'm not talking about food bloat from TechEd. This is where your access tokens, your Kerberos tokens, your users are members of so many groups. And you continually put things in groups, that all those groups are sitting in their access token and there's no more room. You've got token bloat. Dynamic access control is a way of saying, you know, we can solve the problem that is occurring with Kerberos tokens not being big enough to be able to cope with all the access requirements that you've got. And we also have the ability to solve another little problem. Back when Server 2008 was released, there was a fantastic technology called the file classification infrastructure. It enabled you on your file servers to go through and open up files, scan them, PDFs and anything else, find keywords or phrases or things that might be causing compliance issues like US social security numbers, credit card numbers, those sorts of things, and then flag those particular documents, that particular content of being confidential or of being of high business impact. You know, for example, it might be scanning it and find a mention of quantum bubble hard drives. That needs to be protected. It sort of died. Sort of never heard of it for a while. My take on the reason why is because it was too darn difficult to scale. It's excellent for a single machine, provided you put in the effort to do it. But good admins, good sysadmins in particular, are lazy people. That's why we have networks, because it was just gosh darn too much work to have to copy a file, use Sneakernet from one machine to another. In fact, all the great advances in computing have come about because lazy people didn't want to do the work. That's why we have scripting. I don't click, click, I can do that once, but if I have to do it more than three times, I want somebody else to write a script for me to do it. Dynamic access control actually brings both of those things together and says, right, we can fix the file classification infrastructure thing by saying we can actually centralize the rules that are being used to classify and make claims about what this content is, what these resources are. And we can also look at how we're managing the authentication issues that we're dealing with users, the too many groups syndrome. I'm tasked at the moment going through my my organization's Active Directory and having a look at that. And I'm finding universal groups, and we've got a single domain environment. Explain to me how that happens. We have a central access policy ability now to be able to say, we're going to build some rules to say how people are going to be able to access the information. And we can do it in a number of ways. At the moment, we limit access by shares and by NTFS permissions. If you're not familiar with how we can limit access by share permissions and NTFS permissions, you've got some homework to do. We do not take that away. We keep those there, and we're going to add central access policies to that as well. In other words, when we do the check of, are there share permissions involved? Are there NTFS permissions involved? We have to take both of those into account. If there are now central access policies involved, all three now need to be taken into account in order to access these resources. If there is no central access policy that has been written for that particular resource, it'll get ignored. So in a nutshell, we've actually, the bits and pieces for dynamic access control include data classification. So in other words, what are our resources? What sort of resources are they? Are they confidential? Are they financial documents? Do they belong to HR? We have the ability to now do expression-based auditing and expression-based access conditions. Think about it. How do you create access to a resource at the moment? You probably create a group and you put people into that group. Or if you're more pedantic, you create a global group and a local group and you put the people into the global group. You'll add access to the local group, you put the global group into the local group. That's the proper way of doing it. And then we need to give access to another resource over here, and it's never exactly the same sort of permissions or people that are required. So we create another group, and another group, and another group. And the way that we determine access pre this is to say, are you in this group? Or we can say, if you're in this group, or this group, you've got access. We can't, however, go, if you're in that group, and you're in that group, but only if you're in that group, then you can have access. We can now do that. We can also, based on the content and the rules that are applied, determine whether something needs to be encrypted. We'll just flip through to an example. We have user claims, device claims, and resource properties, and I'll just flip through that one. We've talked about checking that. Here's a scenario. I have department engineering, I have sensitivity high, and I have some groups. I have engineering full-time equivalents, I have engineering vendors, and I have sales FTEs. There are people that are in each of these groups. The share for these resources, the department engineering and the sensitivity of the documents is high. They've all got full access because we tend to do that for shares. We control things via NTFS permissions. For the sales, Department of Sales, we don't have a rule for this one. The NTFS permissions are modify for the engineering FTEs, read for the engineering vendors, and the sales FTEs get modify. And the department, if your department is equal to engineering, you have modify access if you're an engineering FTE or a vendor, and you can only read it if you're sales, because goodness knows we don't want the salespeople being able to modify engineering documents. It's also sensitive information. If the information is sensitive, then the full-time equivalents can actually make changes to it, but we don't want to give the vendors any access to sensitive information. By looking at this, what are the effective rights? The effective rights for an engineering FTE would be modify. For a vendor, it would be none. And for a salesperson, it would be read based on the central access policies that are being used. The scenario to deal with token bloat. Let's say we have an organization that has offices in 10 countries. And let's say that we have 10 different divisions that are in that organization, and that structure is replicated across those 10 countries. We have, using groups, 100 groups. You would have somebody who is in, and it could be cities rather than countries if you want. We could have somebody who's in sales Sydney. Someone else would be in sales Melbourne. Someone else would be in sales Brisbane, engineering Sydney, engineering Melbourne, engineering Brisbane, and so on. In order to be able to manage access to these things and have somebody have access to a lot of resources, they need to be a member of a lot of groups. What we can do instead is actually leverage some of those fields in Active Directory that are normally left blank. How many of you actually use the department field inside the user object? Quite a few of you do. That's good. What about the address information with the city and the country location? quite a few of you do. Are you using those fields, though, for access controls, or is it just for reporting of being able to work out where that person is? Just lookups, all right? We have this information here. We can actually use it for a lot more things. So with the claims-based stuff, because the Kerberos token now has the ability to leverage this user information, this stuff that's stored about the user in Active Directory, it can add those claims into the Kerberos token. And when we go and check against the resource, we can say, if the resource here is being classified as belonging to department equals finance, and the user token has their department equal to finance, we can have a rule that says allow this person to have modify access if the resource department equals the user department. We don't need to specify which department. We have a central rule. In the sales area, we can leverage that exact same rule that we've used for engineering over in sales with if resource department equals user department, give them access. If we decide we need to lock down, let's say we've got some rules built up around if company is not equal to whatever, you know, contoso.com or whatever your company is, we can change a rule very quickly to be able to lock down access if we need to across all of our file servers. And this was something that we couldn't do with just FCI by itself. All right. Because we have the ability to severely screw things up if you go changing access rules willy-nilly, it is not a bad idea to do some staging policies, do some tests first, but because replicating your production environment in test to do a full stage of these things are concerned, in the same way that you might be staging group policies, for example. If you create new group policies, it's always a good idea to test them first. All right? You can really screw things up if you don't. Same way with this, but the power to be able to manage with a central set of business-defined rules that are expression-based, based on this claim and this claim and this claim, rather than having to create little groups for everything, can be really, really powerful. We also have the ability to slowly make our way there. So we're not asking you to replace your entire environment. You can add incremental updates. For example, our domain controllers are still 2008 R2, but we have 2012 file servers. We have the ability now, the capability to have central access and audit policies based on security groups and file tagging, but not claims. We also have the ability to implement automatic rights management service if you've got RMS. Once again, based on the security groups and file tagging. If we have a 2012 domain controllers, we also have the ability to now use these central access policies with user claims as well. We're leveraging the information that's already stored in AD for access rather than just lookup and reporting. And finally, if you've got Windows 8 clients, we've actually got a much better improved experience as far as using dynamic access control. Including a better escalation or assistance option. There are also some third parties that are assisting in this regard. Initially, the release from Microsoft was just for file servers. There are organizations I know of who are doing similar things for SharePoint and other platforms as well.
You got any storage vendors that are getting
involved? Good question. Because I'm not Microsoft myself, I can't answer the question, but if you ask the guy with the Tilly hat sitting at the end of the row, he's nodding his head. Rick?
It's just a file server.
It's just a file server? He's the man to talk to. All right. We have, according to me, about 10 minutes to still get you out in time to flip through the last things. So let's do that. Volume licensing. Key management servers. VLKs, wonderful, exciting stuff. Don't you love talking about licensing? Isn't it a joy? It's not. If you think it is, I don't know what you've been smoking or drinking, but it's probably illegal. Or you work in licensing, and for that, you're quite welcome to it. We now have the ability to do activation based on the fact that you are a member of a domain. That should be worth a round of applause, shouldn't it? Take that back, Rick. There are some requirements. Only Windows 8 or Server 2012 machines can leverage this, and we can coexist with KMS. So we're not having to toss out the old, but as you, of course, are all going from Windows 7 to Windows 8.1, Windows XP to Windows 8.1, this is something to look forward to. This is something for future planning. All right? Can make licensing a heck of a lot easier and activation a heck of a lot easier. PowerShell. How many Exchange admins do we have here? Hands up. We've got quite a few. Do you really like the bit where you can actually click and see what the PowerShell command was to do the stuff that you've clicked on? Yeah, we've now got that in AD. In fact, we've improved on the one that was in Exchange for AD. In order to use it, you do need to use the Active Directory Administration Center. But we've got a history and a viewer there to be able to see exactly what's going on under the covers. Fine-grained password policy. Fine-grained password policy is a wonderful thing. It enables us to get around the obstacle of only being able to have one password account policy per domain, which was one of the reasons why many organizations had to go for a multi-domain environment. The recommendation, of course, is to have as few domains as possible. We now have the ability to have fine-grained password policies, different password policies inside the single domain. However, prior to 2012, in order to be able to use this, as the editor and PowerShell, we now have a GUI. That's really nice. We need to have the same functional requirements for having fine-grained password policy, which is only 2008. It came out in 2008. But we need to be using the admin center on Server 2012. There's been quite a lot of changes to Kerberos. I've already mentioned the ability to use user claims inside Kerberos. Some of the other things that we've now removed some of the delegation constraints around it, allowed for larger token sizes. We have the ability now to go cross-forest rather than requiring things to be just in the same domain. So we've added claims. And we've also got some armoring in order to be able to protect from Kerberos man-in-the-middle attacks. Good security stuff. We talked about token bloat, the impact of claims, and there are some numbers associated with that. In the last few minutes I have, before we get to that, group managed service accounts. Is anybody using managed service accounts at all? A couple of hands up. Big problem with managed service accounts? Single machine. You could only have a managed service account being used on a single machine, even though they lived in the domain. It'd be really, really nice if we could have that managed service account being used on multiple boxes. Well, now we can. All right. Group managed service accounts. Do have some requirements. We flip through that. And we also have a lot more PowerShell. If you have been coming along to TechEd for the last few years without understanding that PowerShell is underlying everything and PowerShell is the sort of stuff that you need to know in order to be able to do the good job as an admin, then you've been listening to music or something else or been spending all your time outside the conference center. PowerShell, a lot more commandlets being used, particularly some, as far as AD is concerned, to help with replication management. 2012 R2. Because you are all here, and thank you once again for those of you who are here, those of you who are leaving, please make sure you do the evals. Because you are here, you are missing Carol Wapsch's session on the identity jigsaw puzzle. She is going to be talking a little bit in that about workplace join. That was one of the sessions that I really wanted to go to as well, but said you got me instead. Download that afterwards and have a look at that if you're interested in Workplace Join. Workplace Join is where you can allow a non-domain machine. Now, this is all part of the BYOD strategy. A non-domain machine can connect to domain resources. We create an object in AD that comprises the user account that's authenticating this and the device that they're doing it from. And then we can have device-specific requirements like ensure they've got a password, lockout policies, and that sort of thing applied to that device so we can have some measure of protection. But particularly if you're looking at BYOD and not just for the mobile phones, but extending that to computers and people bringing their own computers, or you've got vendors who typically come in or consultants who come in to do work and want to use their own machines, Workplace Join might be something that you want to have a look at. In line with the whole cloud strategy and being able to have people being able to work from anywhere, we have a new web application proxy. It provides much better access to applications and services from outside, you know, the corporate firewall, worth having a look at as well. And there's been a lot of work with Active Directory Federation services in multi-factor authentication and access control. There are some additional third-party vendors too that are bringing their solutions to hook into ADFS for multi-factor authentication. Remember that the future Active Directory is cloudy, and that's a good thing. Not only are we talking about having on-premise clouds, private clouds, and Windows Azure Active Directory clouds, we've now got the ability to synchronize between the two. Using DirSync and Federation services, it does mean that in the future we have the ability to, instead of requiring a complete data center for our backup environment, we can actually leverage Azure for our backup environments, our DR requirements, and have single sign-on ability to be able to extend our AD infrastructure, our private cloud, our internally hosted infrastructure, being able to access that and duplicate the accounts in that from an access perspective up with the cloud. And since I'm seeing people moving out, last few slides, we're leveraging new technologies, we're extending identity governance reach, we're implementing effective access control. There's more information. Those top three are hyperlinks for most of the information that's in here. There are some extra sessions that were done at TechEd North America that you might want to have a look at. I've got the session codes there for you. Please fill out an eval. Hopefully you'll win a Sculpt mouse. Thank you very much. And if you've got questions, please come here. Otherwise, if you need to get out of here, once again, thank you for coming.